Radio City. John Grace and Rob Ross at it once again. And boy, on an auspicious occasion, here we are on a holiday doing exactly what we're not supposed to be doing today, laboring, putting together our show. What's going on, Rob?
Well, I look at this as a labor of love.
Definitely.
So it's not work. And besides, we don't get paid for it. We should. But we don't. So thus, we take pleasure in whatever we can swing our bats at.
That's right.
At the pinata we call life.
All out of the kindness of our hearts. And it's good to be back in with you on the report. And we're getting a little bit of extra press this week. So a tip of the cap to our good friends at All Access Music Group. They're giving us a little bit of time in the 10 questions section. So if you get a chance, wander over to All Access and check it out. It's mostly about the radio show, but we get a little bit into the podcast as well. So
very, very nice indeed, and a tip of the hat to them, and thank you very much
indeed. And you know, we're seeing less and less press every day, and a big one decided to call it quits this week. It's just unfathomable to think of life without the Village Voice, because frankly, in all of my 49 years, I've never had life without the Village Voice.
That makes two of us, and I am alternately shocked, in a state of disbelief, very sad about it, and at the same time, not surprised. You know, a year ago, they ceased the print edition. So really, it was just a matter of them running out the clock till they shut down the entire operation. And I think it's both a shame and a crime that a cultural institution as vital as the Village Voice has always been, certainly in our lifetimes, that it's gone now. I can't imagine no Village Voice at all. Even, I hate saying it, an online presence is better than none.
Right. Well, and you add into that the fact that it has certainly its place in its own history. It has its place in New York history. But you think of all of the alternative papers around the country, the quote-unquote alternative press that's out there now. And even though a lot of those are now syndicated, they still hire more and better local reporters than anybody else does. I mean, without the Riverfront Times here in St. Louis or Creative Loafing down in Tampa, it wouldn't be the same scene. And you would have these people who wouldn't have any creative output, and they all owe some of their DNA back to the fact that the Village Voice started it all.
I've always thought that all of those kinds of papers were indeed the bastard children of the Village Voice in a positive sense.
Yeah.
You know, they all took their cues. They all said, okay, the Village Voice is obviously endemic of the New York area. Let's do our own version of it, you know, whether it was in Seattle or in Boston or in Philadelphia, you know, the various cities that have the city paper. They were all offshoots of the Village Voice, and they're all to be praised for those who've survived this proverbial physical press holocaust that we've been watching. And it's not just these local papers either, or the local alternative presses, as it were. You've seen how many papers of, well, century-old standing go under.
Right.
As far as print editions go, and some of them in total. But, you know, to me, on the personal side of things, the Village Voice was one of the benchmarks of my formative years, my teen years. You know, it's when I was old enough to be able to go to clubs and see bands. Where did we hear about shows? The Village Voice.
Right. And that's the thing, is that, you know, it was, music was so central to what the Voice was all about, but it was so much more than that too, because you would see articles about some little aspect of life, this underreported aspect of life in New York, that would pop up that didn't necessarily have anything to do with the music scene.
No. And you know what? My very first job out of college, I got through the Village Voice.
There you go.
So, you know, it looms even larger in my own personal history. Never mind every show that I ever got to see in the late 70s, early 80s is directly because I would pick up the Village Voice. In those days, 50 cents and then a dollar every week on Wednesday. And that was my one great splurge, and I never minded it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Well, and again, a sad goodbye to the Village Voice, but this has been a week of sad goodbyes. The Aretha Franklin funeral happened almost simultaneously with the John McCain funeral, and there were, you know, similar crowds at both. I mean, certainly you had people who went to both. I think Bill Clinton was at both funerals, you know, one on one day and one on the next. And the fact that Aretha Franklin's funeral went on as long as it did, I don't know what to say about that other than the fact that she, if anybody deserved it, if anybody gave us enough of her life to be able to warrant that kind of outpouring, it was Aretha Franklin.
No question about it. Notice the presence of ex-presidents.
Yep.
Notice the
absence. Not the current one.
Right. The one sitting president.
Yeah.
While under, you aren't welcome.
Uh-huh.
And that was pretty clear and evident. And not to bring him into the conversation because it would just put an immediate damper on the proceedings. I thought both funerals had nothing but eloquent speeches.
Yep.
As well they should. I thought Bill Clinton was remarkable, as usual, because I still maintain he's probably the finest speaker of our modern presidents.
No doubt.
You know, it was her passing was, in effect, a celebration of an incredible life and the ongoing gift that she gave the world. I think that kind of fits the whole tenor of it. With John McCain, it was nice to see that there was that kind of, this is not about politics. This is about celebrating the life of an American hero who gave his life for and to his country.
Yep.
For that, we both say thank you very much and safe passages.
And I am curious because the one time that the McCain funeral did get intensely political was when his daughter, Meghan McCain, gave her own eulogy. And, there are people, obviously, dependent on where you stand on the political spectrum or what you think of Donald Trump, people have had very different reactions to what Meghan McCain did. And I don't know. I mean, there is an argument to be made there about time and place. But at the same time, if not then, when? When is she going to get that kind of an audience to understand the reason why Donald Trump was disinvited to that funeral and understand exactly what it meant to her and to her family to hear her father's military service denigrated and to hear him denigrated as a human being? Why not then? Why not at his funeral? You know, is that an appropriate thing? Who cares? Really, at the end of it all, who cares what's appropriate or not? She had her shot and she took it.
And it was her father.
Right.
She has the right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it has to be, quote unquote, a proverbial argument over the yes or no, then I vote yes.
There you go.
It was her father. It was his funeral. And it was her moment to say what needed to be said.
Yep.
And like you said, when was she going to have that avenue? Were they going to have her on Fox News? I doubt it. Was CNN going to invite her on? I doubt it. Would MSNBC invite her on? Maybe Morning Joe.
Yeah.
But highly doubtful. I don't think she'd be given that kind of space and form because I'm sure they'd cut to an immediate commercial. You know? So she did what was necessary, and that's all there is to it. It was her father. End of story.
Now, the one political thing that did happen in the New York area specifically that kind of got buried by all of the other news because there was so much else going on, but it still did pop up, you know, here and there, was the debate that took place between Cynthia Nixon and Andrew Cuomo. So take us through it. What did we miss?
You missed the histrionics of a woman who has absolutely no idea what she's doing. She's an actress.
Right.
You know, an actress that was on a really mediocre show that was meant for women and gay men specifically. Sex and the City is not exactly what I would call appeal across the board.
No.
You know? And a marginal actress because she wasn't the star of the show either, by the way. She is a Bernie Sanders person. So immediately she has my thumbing of the nose. Second of all, she's not a politician. She's no different than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Okay? Let's wake up, people of New York who are listening to this show. She's not qualified for anything at all. She's barely qualified to play a role. Okay? You had her going up against Andrew Cuomo, who is possibly one of the biggest wafflers I've seen in many years.
Which is interesting, considering the fact that his father was who he was.
Right, but the thing is, Cuomo in these last few years suddenly has become the master of wishy-washiness.
Yeah.
And I'll get to my real ire with him in a few minutes because it follows right after the debate. But the long and short of it is she went out there to try and insult him and do what the Sanders people tend to do and, you know, well, you're a liar and you're this and you're that. And, you know, he basically made mincemeat of her. And rightfully so. Cynthia Nixon's a moron, okay? And let's not try and beat around the bush here. And let's not forget, the last time we had any kind of Nixon in office, you know what happened. I don't think anybody says. Nevertheless, it was Cuomo's to win or lose, and I think he very clearly won. Now, he's leading, I think, about 30 points ahead of her in what seems to be an almost ridiculously non-race.
Yeah, this isn't a race, right.
I think it's shambolic and pathetic that it's a non-politician, because they're following in the footsteps of Donald Trump, basically, that anyone can do it. Well, if that's the case, why aren't you and I running in our states for various positions?
Right.
If anyone can do it, we can do it a lot better, because we're just normal guys.
Yeah, every radio talk show host in the world believes he can be president, but I may be the one exception to that rule.
You're the one who's possibly qualified.
Yeah. Oh, man. If so, it's the only other thing I'm qualified for. But, yeah, I mean, when it comes to Cuomo himself, you know, I never understood how the apple could fall that far from the tree. I saw Mario Cuomo speak in person once. I mean, I've seen, you know, a dozen of his speeches, but was only in the room ever one time. And he wasn't even running for anything at that point, but if you could walk out of a room not thinking that Mario Cuomo knew his shit, you weren't listening.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Andrew Cuomo knows his shit, but between the scandals that have been falling his administration,
yeah,
and the fact that, like his brother, who's another wishy-washy, all of a sudden ultra-left-wing shill for CNN, I think they're more, not attuned to, but perhaps afraid of this newfound boldness of the ultra left. So they're going to kowtow to their wants and their whims. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. Because I always felt that Andrew Cuomo initially was a lot more, he had a backbone is what I'm trying to say. He doesn't have one now. He's a spineless, gutless wonder. So I don't have very much hope for who's running for governor. I will most likely vote for Cuomo. I would certainly never vote for Cynthia Nixon. I would sooner vote for the Republican if it was, God forbid, Nixon who got the nomination, which I don't see happening.
Yeah.
But my direct anger right now with Cuomo is the fact that suddenly he's in bed with his biggest enemy, de Blasio, because the two of them are in league with the oncoming fare hikes on the MTA, both in 2019 and in 2020. Again, mired with the excuses of they need the revenue too, ... which is complete and utter bullshit. It is a bold-faced lie. And I am sick to death of hearing all of these excuses and stories and why they try to justify these fare hikes of the MTA when an idiot like de Blasio is babbling on about this proposed, and I'm sure we've mentioned this on the show, his proposed streetcar that'll link Brooklyn to Queens. Yeah. It's called the subway, you fucking moron.
Right.
I mean, have you never, and I know this is a rhetorical question, have you never driven from Brooklyn to Queens through the streets? Traffic is difficult enough. Oh, wait a minute. You have, you stupid, incompetent bastard. And the fact that Cuomo is going along with de Blasio in this fare hike is just, it staggers my imagination. So hence, I am beyond livid with Cuomo.
Right.
He lost me completely.
And meanwhile, on the other side of the state, we have a guy who, in my old stomping grounds, a congressman from the Buffalo area, who now is in serious, serious trouble for political corruption and insider trading. So, yeah, it doesn't get any better even when you get outside New York City.
Is that the Republican fellow?
Yeah.
They always seem to get mired in these white-collar crimes, you notice? Dirty, dirty, dirty.
Yep. Right. And this is what, you know, now Donald Trump is out there bitching about on Twitter because he has nothing better to do, saying that, you know, somehow the Justice Department shouldn't have levied these indictments against him or that idiot out in California who is also, accused of political corruption because it's too close to election time. You know, the Department of Justice doesn't care and isn't supposed to care. And in fact, by their charter, can't care about the timing of something like this. If they have evidence enough to indict, they indict, period.
Well, was it not Comey who, very close to an election, decided to bring up the fact of the Hillary Clinton emails?
Yeah, right. Oh, we're shutting the investigation down. No, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. Yes, we are.
Donald Trump wasn't saying anything that was, what was it? You know, he didn't decry that act.
Right.
So, you know, look, Donald Trump is going to say what Donald Trump says. Now, I'm not fobbing it off and I'm not saying, well, this is the new normal or any of that, because I don't accept it and you don't accept it and no one should accept it.
No.
But unfortunately, he's allowed to by virtue of the fact that nobody's done anything to stop him. We've pissed and moaned about it, you and I, that the fact that there's no voice of reason or anyone, you know, shouting him down and calling him out on his actions. Okay, fine. If you guys don't want to be doing your jobs, and that goes for all party members, whether it's, you know, his own party of Republicans who seem to be losing their grip because of him being their scourge, or the Democrats who, as you very rightly pointed out, all they've got is a platform is it's all Donald Trump's fault and nothing else to go on.
We're not him. Vote for us. Yeah, that's not going to work.
Okay, well then, hey, hang yourselves.
Right.
There's plenty of room for all.
Here's going to be the interesting thing to watch, though, between now and November is based on how far he goes down the rabbit hole, how squirrely he gets between now and November, is what the candidates do. And I think what we're going to see is we're going to start to see the map shift a little bit in terms of how people who are running for their phony baloney jobs in Congress deal with him. Because if you're a Republican, and you're running in a deep red district in the middle of nowhere in Missouri or in southern Illinois, you know, out in the sticks in the rural part of town, and you're running as a Republican, you're pretty much bulletproof. And embracing Donald Trump will not hurt you. However, I think the map is going to start to shift in places that are just outside the city centers, places that are a little more purple, you know, that tend to vote Republican because they're full of rich white people, but they're not as ideologically insipid as people out in the, you know, out in the hinterlands tend to be. They're a little more, they're much more highly educated and they're a little less willing to just say, well, he's my guy and I'm on his side, so I'm going to vote for him. And those are the guys, you know, running in those districts around the cities that I think we're going to start to see distancing themselves from Donald Trump. And the more crazy he gets between now and November, the harder it's going to be for them to continue to say, I'm with him.
There's a couple of things to be said about that. First of all, we don't know what's going to happen with the Mueller investigation by November.
Yep.
I mean, I don't want to get off the topic at hand, but I don't know if you saw it or how much truth there was to it, but apparently Cohen has completely flipped and will turn over everything.
Yes.
That he knows. If that is indeed true, this could jump ugly very quick, or uglier, shall we say, very quickly. You know, I know that this is very deep, detailed work. But certainly he's got to have some smoking guns on hand. I mean, we keep waiting for one. That's just, you know, the proverbial hammer coming down on the glass, you know, to smash it to pieces. We haven't really had that yet. We always get these big buildups of, oh, Stormy Daniels says this and Robert Mueller says that and Manafort's been convicted. And
right. But I think that's by design. And again, much to Robert Mueller's credit, I don't think he wants one thing to come out. I think he wants the hammer to come down. I think he wants, when he delivers that report, it is going to be count after count after count after count. It's all going to be indelible. And it's going to be this is why I've been doing this for 2 years. And that's the day that I'm waiting for.
I agree with you completely, because he has to play it close to the vest.
Yep.
He doesn't have a political investment here. His job is to do what he is doing, investigate, find the facts, and deliver the evidence.
Right.
which any good lawyer would be doing.
And man,
good lawyer being an oxymoron.
And in the middle of all of this, what are we, 2 weeks away now or 10 days away from Bob Woodward's book coming out? So that's going to be a hell of a day, too. So, you know, you have a guy who may have started his career by taking down a president, who may end his career by taking down another one. It's going to get insane. And you know, And Donald Trump, in the meantime, you know, everything that he's doing, all of this crazy nonsense, all of the P.T. Barnum crap is, I likened it this week on Facebook, to the end of the Titanic movies where the boat's just about to go down and you start to see the boilers explode, you know, because he can't hold it in anymore. It's driving him nuts. He can't get any answers out of, you know, about what they've got on him. So even the report this week that, you know, Giuliani's got a plan ready to go to refute the Mueller investigation. Well, how the hell can he? He doesn't know what the Mueller investigation is going to show. So again, it's just another boiler exploding because
it's a really bad game of poker,
right? And but they can't play poker, so this is what we're seeing as a result of that. All they know how to do is box, and Mueller's not a boxer.
Well, let me put it to you in Poseidon Adventure terms. It seems like right now Trump is basically Hackman hanging on by his fingers under that heated like steering wheel.
Yep.
The valve just before he drops right into the fire.
Right.
You know, getting back to what we were talking about though, you know, aside from the Mueller investigation, I think a lot of this is also, as we've seen slowly happening, and I'm going to use a word I'm a little uncomfortable with using because I don't want it to be misinterpreted. It's been progressing slowly over the last, I would say 3 or 4 years, that a lot of what were once solid Republican territories and or strongholds and districts are indeed much more purpleized areas.
Yep.
You know, so this election may shift the demographic towards the bluer side. Now, I hold, like I've said many, many times before, absolutely no sway with the notion that we're getting a blue wave. It's not going to happen still. It may be closer than we think,
yep,
but I still think the Republicans will maintain the houses. But, you know, places like Georgia, where they've had a lot, or North and South Carolina, where you have indeed had very close call elections and runoffs, you know, I think you may see tighter races. And the Republicans are acutely aware of this. So they need to have a different tactic. They can't use the whole "I'm the white guy" thing to try and drive away the black vote. They can't suppress voters, try as they might, because they're going to be slapped with court injunctions everywhere they turn.
Right.
So if nothing else, this may prove to be, at least I hope, and hope is a very large word, hope it will be a bit more of an interesting election cycle. Right here in my own backyard, we've got the Republican, Dan Donovan, who I actually think is a good man and deserves to win re-election as DA, versus a fellow named Max Rose. Max Rose, albeit is a soldier, was a soldier, and I respect that and I commend him for that, but his automatic death knell was uttering the name Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
So because of that, there's no fucking way in hell I would ever vote for him. He could not pay me
right
to vote for him. So Donovan's got my vote and my endorsement. And yes, he's a Republican, but here's something else I just want to point out. In Staten Island, we are predominantly Republican, and for Staten Island, Republicans work because they're the checks and balances to an idiot like de Blasio. You know, de Blasio, who knows – the mayor of New York City knows nothing about Staten Island, bar none, except for his spite that he has and his antagonism towards this borough because they didn't vote for him. That's all he knows,
yeah,
and that we have a ferry. So – the Republicans here, believe it or not, are the voice of reason. This isn't a borough filled with Donald Trump. You know, there are some Donald Trump supporters here. But by and large, Staten Island Republicans are like the kind of microcosm that is New York Republicans on the whole. They're, you know, they're the proverbial, you know, they're much more socially accepting and conservative and fiscally conservative types, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. That just says they're a bit more fair and balanced.
Right. And here in Southern Illinois, it's kind of the same scene because you have a very ingrained and very corrupt Democratic machine in Chicago. I mean, this is not a mystery to anybody. So, you know, that's what's going on up there. And a lot of the Republicans who end up at the state level and at the national level becoming elected from Southern Illinois are guys who are largely seen as a check on Chicago. You know, it's like, we can't be like that. The entire state can't be like that. The place would fall apart. So, you know, so you end up with a bunch of guys who, while, you know, there's a guy that I know who's a U.S. congressman from the district just north of here. His name is John Shimkus, and he's a Republican, and the people in his district love him for the reasons that people usually love politicians. He brings home a lot of attention and a lot of pork. And he's kind of a dope, but he's sort of a harmless dope. So, okay, sure, he's a Republican, but you know what? Fine, whatever. You know, he's not going to hurt anybody.
Okay. I mean, I can buy that, certainly. Look, New York had, I thought, a pretty great governor for three terms in George Pataki, who was a Republican.
Right.
People forget that, and it's easy to forget that. You know why? Because he worked for everybody in the state. And he seemed to get along well with the president at the time, who happened to have been Bill Clinton.
Right. But that's the whole point. You know, when we start talking about, is it going to be a red wave? Is it going to be a blue wave? It doesn't really compute that way because, I mean, Donald Trump could screw it up for his own party simply by driving voter turnout down. That's the only thing he can do at this point. But as far as all of the rest of it goes, every district still has its own voters with their own issues and their own problems. So, it may shift.
Let's not forget also the fact that you have right now the big mouths and the bravado and the bluster of the millennials out there who are all doing their part, quote unquote, because they're all virtue signaling and waving flags and hashtagging this, that, and the other. And you know what? Come time to vote, will they actually lift their lazy asses to register and do their jobs?
No.
Probably not.
No. And I can say that with the same confidence you are right now because we've heard that since I was one of them. You know, I've voted in every election that I was.
You're never a millennial.
No. But I mean, when I was of that age group, when I was 18 to 24 or whatever, when I was there, people were saying the same thing about us. Are they actually going to show up and vote? And I did. And, you know, a few of my friends did, but it was by no means in the numbers that we could have. You know, we could have stood up to the PMRC and all that shit, and we just didn't. We had better things to do. And so, yeah, depending on young people to actually show up at the polls, especially in an election that isn't for president, fool's errand. And it will always be a fool's errand.
The reason why I got on the Pace University Democratic Committee was because there was a girl who was in both my philosophy and...
It's always a girl.
One of my psych classes, she was absolutely gorgeous. We were crazy about each other. She had a boyfriend, I had a girlfriend, but we dug each other. And so, you know, hell, I was going to make that a political campaign of my own.
Do a little polling?
Oh, I did a lot of polling. And on election night, I won.
There you go.
You know, but, you know, let's bring up something else because it is indeed Labor Day. And I was just wondering, you know, When somebody says to you the words Labor Day, what's the first thought that comes to mind? Just immediate reaction.
Oh, Jerry Lewis, telethon.
Exactly. And, you know, how many years has it been that the telethon's been off, let alone the fact that this is the first full year without Jerry? I mean, yeah, he died a year ago, but still, this is the first full year without him, period. It still feels weird and uncomfortable, you know? I always mourn the day, and I haven't even looked it up yet online to see if it's on YouTube somewhere. I always look for that moment when, you know, Jerry is just so doped up to the eyeballs on Percocet, and he's falling off his stool, just trying to warble his way through You'll Never Walk Alone. When you walk through a storm, keep your head up. You know, I lived for that, you know?
Yeah.
The telethon to me was my kidhood. You know,
right?
And like the last bell tolling for the Village Voice, the Labor Day telethon not being there anymore is just another sign that, you know, I got one foot on in the grave and the other on a banana peel. You know?
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean.
Listen, I'll grant you this: we all know that the telethon was going downhill when Schmoll died, but the fact is, this isn't Labor Day anymore. It's just a day off.
Yeah, there's, you know, the summer's over and it's just one more reminder. And speaking of the summer being over, by the way, I don't know how they're dealing with this in New York, but the kids around here went back to school 3 weeks ago, which is also a devastating evil.
They start on Wednesday here.
So good. So New York is still human. Yeah, that's good to know, because that was always the rule. It was always either the Wednesday or the Thursday after Labor Day. It was never 3 weeks, you know, 1 week into August, everybody goes back to school. What is this crap?
Now, John, because you're slightly younger than I am, let me learn you a little something here. When I first started going to school, it was always the Monday after Labor Day. It was 1 week after Labor Day.
Okay, yeah.
That's how it began. And that was how it was throughout public school. When I was in junior high school, then all of a sudden we started going, starting on the Wednesday after Labor Day, which didn't sit well with me. But by that time, I was already in my, you know, the beginning of the pre-teen years, you know. High school, because I went to a prep school for high school, because, you know, I'm privileged and I'm white. Because I went to a prep school, I believe we started somewhere around, it was usually around the 10th or the 11th.
Nice. You see, yep. In Buffalo, it was always, like I said, it was that Thursday after Labor Day, which was kind of cool because it gave us a couple of days to get in, just get our bearings. Yeah, we're back to this stuff again. And then we got a weekend so we could just breathe again and deal with it. And then it was back to the grind on Monday. But when I moved to Florida, that was my first inclination that it was starting to move backwards, because there we did go back the last week of August, not the second week, the last week of August, and got the first day off was Labor Day. But the other thing about that was, because there were no built-in snow days, because it was Florida and it doesn't snow there, we always got out really early. We'd get out at the, you know, the second week of May. Where in Buffalo, geez, it was not unusual for us to be in school on June 2nd.
Well, first of all, the great thing about starting, well, public school from kindergarten through fifth grade, around the seventh or whatever it was the fact that, it gave us a chance to absorb the fact that we had to prepare ourselves for school. Junior high school, again, that started a little earlier, so that was always off-putting, but that was only 3 years. Ninth through 12th grade, high school, you know, of course, what was great about starting around the 11th was it gave you time to get over your depression that school was starting to
right.
get. Because for a lot of us normal people, high school sucks, you know, and high school is torturous. And the last thing you want to do is go back to high school. The one thing I had going for me in high school was the fact that I was neither a Guido nor a stoner. I was a punk rock weirdo. So I didn't have the look, but I had the credentials, because you didn't dress the part, first of all.
Yeah.
And because I was so into the whole mod thing, I fit perfectly in prep school, obviously. But nonetheless, I would just get really, really uptight and depressed around the start of high school. And the way that my mother dealt with it was, rather than put me in therapy or put me on meds, she always take me record shopping for like a splurge.
That is therapy.
5 or 7 albums, and that would keep me cheerful through the week.
Yeah.
You know? And that always worked, because that happened right before high school, when I finally was able to track down, at that time, a deleted album, but an important album in the annals of rock history nonetheless, The Who Sellout. So when I started high school, I went armed with this album that completely catapulted my life into a direction that I could not have foreseen, truly. And it was only a few short weeks later that I wound up buying my first guitar.
Nice.
And it got me through my freshman year of high school, which was very difficult, you know, at the outset. Once I had the guitar, at the end of the day, I'd be home after home. I would usually do my homework before the school day was ended anyhow, because I just didn't want to be bothered after I got home. So the moment I walked in the door and picked up that guitar, I would play till I went to bed, you know. Thus, for me, there's those different stages of when, you know, when I went to college, you know, I always enjoyed September. I always seemed to do much, much better in the fall semester than the spring semester. I never understood why. I always wound up with straight A's as opposed to A minus B, you know, because right. I'm like that. But that's school for you, kids. Regardless, stay in school, stay off the drugs, Crack is whack. Just say no.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you should put it in those terms. You know, because we didn't have the telethon, one of the things I found myself doing over this weekend, we just got back from the movies, by the way, and saw a pretty interesting little film, which I'll tell you about in a minute, but spent a lot of time kicking around on the streaming services on Hulu and HBO Now and all of that, watching documentaries. And you did too. And I find this fascinating that we ended up in the same place at the same time. So you start this one. What documentary did you see?
Now, I just want to preface this by saying that this is the second documentary I've seen about this band in about as many years. The first one was a lot more, dare I say, predictable / standard kind of documentary. Dry, informative, but mostly dry. You know, you didn't get a real feeling. Okay, because it was made of compilations of clips and interviews and some things that you've seen before. But this one that is on Showtime at the moment is called If I Leave Here Tomorrow, a film about Lynyrd Skynyrd. And this is absolutely fantastic. Even if you're not a fan of the group or know nothing about them, watch this. It's intelligent. It's stunning to watch visually. It is gripping. These are fantastic filmmakers who really knew how to put something special together. And it made me go back and listen to my few Skynyrd albums, to be very honest with you, and enjoy them all over again. It has as current as you could get interviews with Artemis Pyle, Gary Rossington, Ed King, who, of course, only died 2 weeks ago, and probably the last interviews with Bob Burns, who was the original drummer who died around the time that they completed the making of this movie. It is a fantastic film. It goes the complete extent of their career, you know, from the beginnings of when they were kind of a psychedelic group till they actually became Lynyrd Skynyrd. They take you through the early years in a lot of depth, through the years of success, through the accident. They don't really go into the reunion, if you will, of 87 and onward, which is fine because it's about Lynyrd Skynyrd, the band that most of the world knows and reveres as the band that went down in the plane crash in Mississippi. But it is, as I said, visually stunning. It's gripping. Fantastic filmmakers. Kudos all around. You have to see this. If you weren't a fan before, I bet you will become a fan afterwards. And what's really interesting is what you learn about them as people. And that's what this documentary absolutely shows you, who they were and what they were about as people. To get into some of the deeper elements of this band's psyche is fascinating because all they're known as is this, you know, Southern rebel rock, hard drinking, hard fighting, rednecks.
Right.
But it belies the myth.
Good. So it delves into the musicianship and all of that, that part of it, the serious band part.
And the serious people part.
Nice.
This is something that people, very few people have ever really gotten. You get to know the members of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that. And we watched a couple of them, as I said, and one of them we're going to get a lot more into in the In Our Head segment. That's going to kick that off. So the other one, though, had nothing to do with music. And I don't even know why, but I was just looking through what was there. We just signed up for HBO Now, which is their streaming service. And so I decided to just kind of go on a deep dive to see what I could find in there. And ended up with a documentary, and it was very short, which appealed to me. And it was about a subject that I knew almost nothing about, which also really appealed to me. It's called I Have Tourette's, But Tourette's Doesn't Have Me. And
I have seen it.
It is outstanding. And the great thing about it is it focuses on kids who look like they're anywhere between probably 10 and 12 or 10 and 14. And it's just a bunch of kids that have Tourette's syndrome. And they interview them about, okay, what is life like for you? What do people need to know about this? What makes it difficult? What, if anything, makes it easier for you to deal with? And the answers that these kids give, the first thing that really struck me about it is that every single one of them was speaking at a level that was so much higher than his or her age would dictate. And they were talking about these deep concepts and, you know, just it was very philosophical. And I thought, wow, where did these kids come from? I was not that philosophical when I was 12 years old. But I guess maybe, you know, dealing with that kind of adversity forces you into a situation where you have to think about things that you don't normally have to think about as a kid. And the most poignant moment to me was this young man, and I don't remember what his name was, but he just, they ask him what was, you know, what was hard about going to school with Tourette's, and he said, "I can't stand substitute teachers." And I thought, you know, all of a sudden it just hit me. I'm like, holy shit, to think about what this kid must have to go through every time a substitute comes in and he has to explain to them, here's what's going on. Here's why I'm doing this. I'm not cutting up just to be a jerk. You know, I'm not looking for attention. I have this disease and there's nothing I can do about it. But to have to go through that and you're teaching the adults something, and still he was saying, you get the ones who just don't want to believe it and will get on you and say, stop doing that. I can't, you know, it was really enlightening, really eye-opening. And you got it from their perspective in a way that was completely coherent to an adult.
You're going to have a lot of fun, I think, with watching documentaries on HBO, because they do have a lot of really good ones.
Yep.
Their sports documentaries as well are excellent. I have Tourette's, but it doesn't have me. It was hard to watch at first, you know, yep, because you feel for those kids. It's hard not to cry, but then you can't help but think, nope, 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 they're not crying. Why should you?
Right.
You know? And, you know, there's a series on A&E about, you know, kids living with Tourette's.
No, I didn't.
So, yeah. So, you know, it's a case of HBO, for their lack of anything else now, especially in terms of original programming, save for The Deuce, which is coming back, I believe, next week.
Okay.
They do manage to bring some really good documentaries to the table. Not all winners, but some are great, and some are just – the sports ones are excellent. I mean, for God's sakes, Miracle on Ice is still their masterpiece.
Sure.
Without a doubt. If I remember correctly, they did the original documentary on the Brooklyn Dodgers, which I'll tell you something. Considering that I was born long after the Dodgers had left, you couldn't help but feel it. You couldn't help but almost picture it in your mind, and you weren't even alive or there. But it was so vivid and so well done, and heartbreaking too, because you felt a sense, you could understand what the community was going through when they lost the Dodgers.
Right.
You know?
And that always makes it special, and sometimes in the most twisted and weird of ways, when you can put it into a context that's real for you because, well, you're there. You can walk by those places that are in that documentary and go, yep, it's right there. Here I am. I'm part of this.
You know, and the funny thing is, you know, as now keeping in mind, we're talking about now the era when we were kids and we were old enough to know who we liked and who we hated.
Right.
You know, we all hated the Philadelphia Flyers when the Broad Street Bullies were at the heights of their destruction. But yet you watch the documentary that HBO did on them, and you can't help but like them.
I will never like them. They kept my Sabres from winning the cup.
But you know, that was the fog, really.
Yeah, right. That's true. That, I think. But yeah, the other one. And by the way, at the movies this week, we just came back from. Just came back from seeing this movie called Juliet Naked.
The Nick Hornby book.
Yes, and the movie. It's a rom-com, so it. You know, goes with some of the similar tropes that are in all of them, but they do some things in it that are really cool. Before that, though, the other one documentary I had a connection to was, I think it was Showtime. You know what? Who did America Undercover? Was that Showtime or was that HBO?
HBO.
It was at HBO? Okay, so it was HBO. And one of their America Undercover documentaries from 1988 was called Why Did Johnny Kill? And it spotlighted all of these kids who were teenagers who murdered people. And the one that they spotlighted in the episode that I watched was a kid who was the lifeguard at the public pool that I used to go to when I was a kid.
Jesus.
Yeah. Killed his entire family. And I thought, wait a minute. And I'm, you know, kind of half paying attention and I'm looking at these places going, hey, that's Mang Pool. I used to go there. And then they showed the kid and I went, oh, it's John Justice. I knew that dude. Yeah. Crazy. Oh, just insane.
Justice. How very ironic.
Oh, yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, he did. He killed his parents and I think a brother or a sister. No, it was a brother. And then tried to kill himself by driving the car down Elmwood Avenue, this little street that goes through Kenmore, at like 90 miles an hour, smashed into another car, which just happened to be his next door neighbor. The next door neighbor died. Johnny was fine. So he spent a lot of time in the psych institution. And I think he actually did some time behind real bars for a while. But still, you know, got to the point where he was still a juvenile, so they had to let him out. I don't know where he is now.
Yeah, I mean, if that's already 30 years ago, that's you never know where anybody is at this point.
Right.
That's for sure.
But yeah, the Juliet naked thing, very well done. And, you know, Rose Byrne, hey, what are you going to complain about seeing Rose Byrne? No. It was fine. The Chris O'Dowd, I love from the IT Crowd. And there are some parts in the movie that are very funny. It does, like I said, it does a couple of the standard issue rom-com tropes. But the music part of it, and the fact that, you know, the central character in this thing is a guy who walks away from a brilliant musical career and becomes the stuff of legend and nobody knows where he is. And he shows up about halfway through the film. But, you know, Chris O'Dowd plays this guy who is totally devoted to him and has this huge man crush on this musician and runs a website that's dedicated to, you know, finding this guy and finding all of this information. And it's like a blog and a clearinghouse for all of the rumors about him. And the character of the musician himself is played so smoothly and so exactly like everybody that I've ever known who was a musician of any, you know, of any renown whatsoever, that I thought it's worth seeing just because it's very loving of the music. And by the way, the Kinks song Waterloo Sunset plays a central role in the movie as well.
Terry meets Julie, Waterloo Station.
The same way I'm not going to complain about looking at Rose Byrne, I'm sure as hell not going to complain about hearing Waterloo Sunset.
Well, Ethan Hawke is the one who plays the musician.
Right.
See, the thing that I find interesting is because I love Nick Hornby's writing. He's a wonderful writer. From the time that I first read High Fidelity when it initially came out. And I remember people saying to me, you should read this because it sounds an awful lot like you. And when I read it, I got really pissed because it did sound like me. Yeah. Really. It almost sounded like he'd heard me having one of these conversations or ranting and raving, as I was very much wont to do back then, and then going home and putting it in an English setting. And I didn't like that. I was really uncomfortable with it. But it was a brilliant book because it was realistic and it was so visual.
It was also a brilliant movie.
The thing is, though, I found it to be compromised in an Americanized way by the film version because it was such an English book. I could picture that British record store. I could picture what they looked like. In fact, if anybody should have played the character of Rob, it should have been Robert Carlyle.
Okay.
He would have been perfect in the role of, well, Rob Fleming in the book, Rob Gordon in the movie. Cusack was fine, and the movie was I took umbrage with certain things that they took out of the book and put in the movie that I didn't think really worked. But nevertheless, you know, I didn't like the fact that there was Nick Hornby's first book, Fever Pitch, was about this fellow's obsession for Arsenal, but his kind of forgetting that he had a serious girlfriend.
Yeah.
There was an original movie made about that with Colin Firth in the lead role, and it worked. It worked perfectly. But then they did that really limp-wristed version with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore, and Red Sox setting, and
yeah,
did that. About a Boy was done perfectly. It was actually, I thought the movie was better than the book because the book is pretty bleak.
My favorite part of the English version of Fever Pitch is when the girlfriend is busy explaining to her best friend about this guy she just met, and the girl listens to the description and goes, "Oh, he's a yob." I was like, "Yep, pretty much."
You know, the one great thing about, well, there's two great things about the movie version of About a Boy. One, Rachel Weisz.
Uh-huh.
Number two, Rachel Weisz.
Right.
And it was really, it was just, it, this satisfied a lot more than the book. In fact, I actually thought the movie ended on a lot more of a logical closure point than the book did. The book kind of meandered its way into deliberate sadness, for lack of a better phrase.
Okay.
Now, I haven't seen Juliet Naked yet, so I'll reserve judgment to make the comparison. I read the book. I very much enjoyed it. As much as people have their mixed feelings about Ethan Hawke, I'll just say, hey, that's my bike.
There you go. Yeah, and nothing wrong. And, you know, in Boyhood, I mean, all the performances that he put in throughout the filming of Boyhood, that's some pretty heavy-duty acting.
Look, my only real problem with Ethan Hawke is it takes a special kind of fucking idiot to let Uma Thurman get away.
Yeah.
And the same kind of, you know, award goes to Gary Oldman because he was a drunk idiot. But still, you have to be some kind of fucking retard to let her get away.
One of the trailers, and I agree, one of the trailers that we saw in advance of this movie was for one I had not heard anything about yet, and I don't know when it's coming out, but it's a retelling of the Lizzie Borden story, and it stars Chloe Sevigny as Lizzie Borden. And it's much more in the sort of art house vein of a look at this story, but it puts in a character, played by Kristen Stewart, who is having an affair with Chloe Sevigny as Lizzie Borden. So, yeah.
Yes, it's stupid and completely marginalizes it, and it's just so typical of filmmakers and writers right now. How predictable.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so it's taking a story and, you know, putting a whole bunch of things in it that didn't really happen. And
also, Chloe Sevigny, nothing special to look at. Kristen Stewart, God's gift to as interesting as watching paint dry. No, okay. Watching paint dry at least has a point to it.
She covers the spectrum of acting from A to B, and I'm serious about that. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm probably going to wait for it to come out streaming, and then I'll just invite my friends over, and we'll drink a lot and do the Mystery Science Theater 3000 routine.
Shall we already start doing the obvious, calling it Lizzie Borden?
I mean, yeah, right. How did I miss that? So...
Come on, you bunch of fucking retard filmmakers, you should all be ashamed of yourselves, and you should all be strung up, every last one of you.
I don't
care what you are, gay, straight, male, female, black, white, Jewish, Christian, all of you.
Right.
You're all a bunch of fucking hacks.
I do want to go back, though, to one other thing, back to the back to school thing for a minute, because even though they have moved everything in the year earlier, except in New York, where you do things right,
not everything, but okay. I appreciate the vote of semi-confidence.
But you look back at what was always the death knell of summer for us, and it was watching those TV commercials start to come on for the back to school sales. And I was like, oh no, really? Are we doing this again? And that, do they do the tax-free day anywhere near you?
Yeah. I don't think they're kind of random when they do it. Plus, it is tax-free on clothes up to a certain point.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, that's always kind of helpful. But, you know, when I knew shit was happening and I could almost smell it was when the first back-to-school flyers appeared in the Sunday papers.
Right.
You'd always stick it into the color section. You know, back-to-school specials from Kmart. Oh, boy. Woolworth. Back to school specials.
Get 35% off your Scooby-Doo lunchbox.
Oh, boy. My favorite lunchbox of all of them. And I had many, many over my my public school years. My favorite was my Sizzlers lunchbox.
Nice.
That was my favorite. It was not metal. It was the one in that first wave of plastic lunchboxes. It was square. And it was just really cool because it had the Sizzlers cars on it, you know. Of course, it said Sizzlers by Mattel.
Right.
Even though it's pretty much a Matchbox kid, no matter how you looked at it. That was my favorite. My second favorite was in second grade, my Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan.
Ooh, various. I had Hong Kong Phooey. I did have Scooby-Doo. I had a Star Wars lunchbox. In I would have been seven, so that would have been what, second grade? Yeah. And that one was cool because it had the little metal clip that held the thermos in place. So yeah. You know, so
that
it didn't
the best group of them.
Oh yeah. And it was great because that way the thermos didn't slide across and smash your peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Uh-huh. My first square metal lunchbox was just plain plaid, but it had that metal clip.
Yep.
It had the glass thermos inside, you know, the glass lined thermos. My very first lunchbox was a Snoopy lunchbox, and it looked like a lunch pail.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah.
Thermos fit on the upper side of it.
Right.
And everything else was on the bottom. Then I had a Peanuts lunchbox, which had like various strips around it and on it. Did I have any other cool ones? No, because by fifth grade, I just decided, what the fuck am I doing eating lunch in school? I live around the corner, so I go home for lunch.
I remember.
My last year of kidhood in that respect.
I just remember because I was such a huge fan of Hong Kong Phooey. I remember once going to the movies with my dad, because that was our dad and son out day, was always going to the movies. And he told me about a month ago, he was like, yeah, you know, that's because I was usually just high as a kite, right? I just wanted to sit in a nice, cool, dark theater and watch a fun movie. But that's fine. So because of that, I saw everything. I mean, there was a movie called Gray Lady Down about a sinking submarine that we went and saw one time. I remember that one. He took me to all the Mel Brooks movies. He took me to weird movies. Dad took me on one of those trips to see Damnation Alley, which was this futuristic Michael Vincent thing. And so it was movies usually like that had some kind of weird quirk to them. We also went and saw the original Rollerball with James Caan.
Did you go see Tora, Tora, Tora?
Definitely. And Midway in Sense Around. So,
yep. Of course, we all saw Earthquake and we also saw Roller Coaster.
That's right. The only three theatrical releases, if memory serves, in Sense Around before people realized, wait a minute, that shakes the theater next door, too.
So, it's really not that effective.
No. But the one that will always bring a smile to my face is Silver Streak. Because Scatman Crothers was the porter in Silver Streak, and he was the voice of Hong Kong Phooey. So there I was sitting there watching this movie, and I didn't know who he was, but all of a sudden I heard Hong Kong Phooey's voice coming out of him and went, whoa. Did you
watch Chico and the Man?
Yeah, but I think that was after. Silver Streak was 75, I think.
Oh, okay.
So,
because I remembered him from, you know, the minute I heard that voice on Chico and the Man, I'm like, oh, it's Hong Kong Phooey.
Right.
Number one super guy.
Yes. But
he's got style, Phooey style, and a car that just won't stop.
Brilliant. Silver Streak was 76. So that would have been concurrent with the beginnings of Chico and the Man. But yeah, just great movie. Really, you know, and that was the first time Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor were on set together. And it was just magic.
You know, you brought up something and we've talked about it sparingly in the past, but I'm going to use the T word, God help me, but in the right context. But you just triggered a memory in the fact that the other giveaway that school was starting was, of course, the upcoming Saturday morning cartoons.
Right.
Because the new cartoons would start that first weekend before school was on in full throttle. Or at least you would get the previews show on NBC, CBS, and ABC the Friday before the cartoons started.
Yeah. I remember the year they rolled out Captain Caveman.
that was part of the Flintstones Comedy Hour, right?
Yeah. And
that wasn't during the Pebbles and Bam Bam show when they were teenagers, right?
That was, it was right around the same time. So it must have been because, the Hanna-Barbera stuff was on Channel 7, if memory serves right. And then Channel 4 was all of the Bugs Bunny, the Warner Brothers stuff and all of that.
Down here in the city, it was CBS always had, up until about 78 or 79, it went back and forth, and it originally began on ABC.
Okay.
From about 66 till about, let's say, 78, 79, CBS had Bugs Bunny. Or the Bugs Bunny that we always refer to, the Overture, Turn the Lights,
right.
This is that Bugs Bunny
show. Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour.
Right. Then they would have a lot of the other Hanna-Barbera shit. They had, they initially had the Wacky Races, mm-hmm. the Penelope Pit Stop, the Adventures of Dastardly and Muttley. CBS had the Teenage Pebbles and Bam Bam show. That was the show that had one of my favorite characters that I still refer to this day that nobody remembers, Schleprock.
Schleprock. Schleprock
would always walk around and he had a cloud over his head. Right. And it was thunder and lightning, and his catchline was wowsy, wowsy, woo, woo. People get really irritating. I will do that to them.
Yep.
To this day, because I'm like that.
Oh, man.
But also CBS had one of the all-time truly great Saturday morning shows that you would have to wind up eventually smoking pot to go back, think about, and understand. And that was the Hudson Brothers Razzle Dazzle Comedy Show.
Yeah.
Which was unadulterated brilliance because it was also the show that was that introduced us to Murray Langston, who, of course, became famous later on as the Unknown Comic.
Right.
That show was just beyond fucked up stoner humor that little kids loved and we didn't know why. It's when you got high later on, you figured out why you liked it so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we also, you were there at the tail end of it. I kind of missed out, but I got to see them all in reruns. The Hanna-Barbera stuff from the late 60s that was just fantastic. Oh, man, how many? Snooper and Blabber, Augie Doggie and Doggie Daddy, Wally Gator, McGilla Gorilla. I mean, just...
Ricochet Rabbit and Drupal.
Yes.
Hippopotamus. who else? The early 70s ones weren't too bad. These again were on
was Top Cat not part of that as well?
Top Cat was actually before all of those. Okay. Top Cat was just on the tail end of the Jetsons.
Right.
Top Cat was, I think, 64 or 65.
And that was the Bowery Boys, right? I mean, that whole thing was just a rip of the Bowery Boys.
And then, you know, we had things like Help It's the Hair Bear Bunch.
The Hair Bear Bunch, yeah. A
bunch of hippie bears.
Who were the dog detectives?
Oh, Snooper and Blabber.
Snooper and Blabber were the cat and the mouse. Cat,
Blabbermouse, right. Super Snooper and Blabbermouse.
Yep. But there was, I can see him.
So those, and of course, Huckleberry Hound, and of course, Pixie and Dixie and Mr. Jinx.
Right.
You know, the two little smart alecky nieces and poor befuddled Mr. Jinx, the cat. And of course, heavens to Murgatroyd.
Snaggletooth.
Who was originally, or Snaggletooth, whatever. One was pink, one was orange. I don't remember.
Right.
And they were both kind of theatrical.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like that.
He was, and of course, Huckleberry Hound was blue.
Flamboyant.
Yes, he was a fancy, fancy cat.
Yep. But yeah, as we leave the cartoons and get into the In Our Head segment, as I said, there were a couple of the documentaries that we happened to catch over the weekend. One was that one about Tourette's syndrome. The other one was part of a series on the 80s, not the CNN one, not the one that Tom Hanks did the voiceovers for, although that was brilliant in its own way. But I think this one was on the History Channel, and we just started watching a few of them. One of them was on the beginnings of the sort of religious right takeover of family values. And then the next one after that was about the pop culture wars and Tipper Gore and the beginnings of the PMRC. And what I had forgotten about that era, I mean, I knew the whole thing started with Darling Nikki and, you know, the girl masturbating with a magazine and how that freaked out one of these Washington senators' wives. And therefore, we had the Tipper stickers later on. But I remember Dee Snider, and they showed the whole thing, his testimony in front of the Senate and the fact that Al Gore essentially was shooting darts out of his eyes at Dee Snider that entire time. Because here's this guy walked in, looked like he just came off the street with a wig on and the whole deal. And he said in those 2 or 3 minutes, the most erudite and well put together testimony that entire hearing heard from either side. And he just blew everybody away. But the thing that they brought out is they reminded me of the Filthy 15, one of which was Under the Blade by Twisted Sister. And it was these 15 songs that they really wanted to target hard. And you look at the bands that were on that list, and it was bands like not just Twisted Sister, but Def Leppard was in there, and all of these just milquetoast, middle of the road rock acts that were supposed to be the Filthy 15. And it's hilarious now to look back at all this stuff. But they brought out a memory that I had all but erased. The fact that when those stickers started to show up on the albums, people started wearing them on t-shirts, you know, and they were everywhere, and it became a kind of a badge of honor. And kids would go through the stacks of records because they didn't stop from selling them. All it did was put the sticker on there. So you could still at age, whatever, 11, you could go up and buy a Twisted Sister album. The sticker didn't stop anything and the record stores didn't give a shit. So it became,
they made them more money that way.
Right. And it became a signal to us, the consumers, this is what you want to listen to. So we would look for the stickers because we wanted to buy those albums. So is there one that you remember having a sticker that you bought specifically because it had the sticker on it?
Actually, I'll go you one better because I never gave a shit about the stickers no matter what.
Yeah.
I always to this day look for unedited of anything, whether
yes.
it's an album or a DVD. When that was happening, when that was beginning, when that was taking place, I was in Music 147 class in my return to college. It was called Rock and Contemporary Culture. And for the final, the girl that I was in love with, I couldn't call her my girlfriend, but I was wooing her very heavily. You know, we would go on dates and stuff. For the final, I helped her put together, she wanted to do a thing on songs that were banned and albums that were banned because this was a very current thing, starting with Wake Up Little Susie, which caused a furor
yes.
in the 1950s.
Right.
You know, we've both been sound asleep. Wake up, little Susie, and we, the movie's over, it's 4 o'clock, and we're in trouble deep.
Yeah, even though the fact that they were out that late was totally innocent in the song. It's totally innocent, and yet it was still
well,
too much.
They told her mama she'd be in by 10. Well, Susie, baby, looks like we goofed again. Wake up, little Susie. Wake up, little Susie. We gotta go home. So that's where it began, and we took a couple of things from the 60s that had been banned because, you know, obviously they were overtly political. And so we basically did, even though it was her presentation, she and I wrote, you know, the history of censorship and banning songs. But then we got to the hardcore part because I was working at the record store at the time. So she was able to present things not just like Twisted Sister or Purple Rain or any of those, you know, but things like Fuck Like a Beast by Wasp.
Yeah, right. Blackie Lawless. You know? Sure.
Things like that. And it was an incredibly powerful, well done, no shock value intended. And I'm happy to say she got an A for it.
Excellent. Well done.
You know? Well, yeah. I mean, just this, the postscript was, I, on the other hand, for my finale, final project, was rather than write or present something, I sang the history of the Beatles through their acoustic ballads, and I had Carl, our bass player, come in and do them with me. But we didn't go for the obvious, except for maybe Yesterday, you know, because that's a mid-period track,
yep.
and it is acoustic. We did think we started with something like Ask Me Why.
I love you, because you tell me things I want to know, and it's true.
Yes, I Love You. And then we did, you know, And I Love Her and If I Fell, especially because it had the harmonies in it, and so on and so forth. And one of the main songs that we did was, of course, Till There Was You. And after it was over, and, you know, the class had dismissed, and that was the final class, I remember my professor, Dr. Koblet, saying, I'm begrudgingly going to give you an A+, but I really should just give you an A. And I just looked at him very horrified. I was like, why? He goes, because Until There Was You, it's not a C7th, but an F sharp. And he showed it to me, and I never played it wrong after that.
There you go. It's good to learn.
Yeah, he did it with a grin. Well, I'm also the asshole that got 105 on my midterm, which I saved until I moved out of my parents' house, because I was the asshole who had to answer the bonus question, you know?
Yeah.
What band were Roger McGuinn, David Crosby, Chris Hillman, Gene Clark, and Michael Clark in? And somebody actually wrote Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That fucking bonus question, John.
I think I would have gotten that one. But, yeah, see, with me, of all things, because I was in the same boat you were, I was the rock and roll kid, I was the punk kid, I was the heavy metal kid. I had no interest whatsoever in rap or anything that had to do with it until the trial started. And as soon as they put Two Live Crew on trial, I had to go buy that album. And I did, and I've loved it ever since. As nasty as they want to be, and the clean version that they released on their own volition after that, clean as they want to be, that's a fantastic piece of work. And, you know, Luke Skywalker, who will for me always be Luke Skywalker, Luther Campbell, is a brilliant guy. You know, he's a mover like everybody else in the music industry is a mover, but he is one of the deepest thinkers that you will find in that cadre of performers. And I love him to pieces.
All I will say about rap is very simply, how do I put this? I'm the cream of the crop. I rise to the top. I don't need a pig because a pig is a cop. I'm a Terminator like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I came to get down. I came to get down. So get out your seat and jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump up and get down. Jump, 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 jump.
That's going to hold us until next time around. And always, as always, we will look forward to it, Rob Ross.
Was that in our heads?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I didn't even know it.
It's all about the tipper stickers, man.
Fucking A. Wow, you know what? See, that's what it's really good. You don't even know you're in the last segment. Holy mud. Wow.
I'll make more of an announcement about it next time. All right, man. Well, have a brilliant week. Enjoy yourself, and we'll do it all again next time.
Absolutely. And hey, the next time we do, it's the start of another new year for your people and mine.
That's right. Yeah, what are we up to? 6,000 and what now?
I don't know. Call my accountant.
See you, Rob.
Have a good one, brother.